It's almost 7 a.m, but still the dark of night here in rural County Cork. Anna Sullivan runs from her home in her dressing gown and shoes. She's trying to get help. She needs to drive away, up the long laneway leading from the farmhouse to the road. But first she has to unlock the large gate in the yard. She reaches the gate. She stops. Her key won't work. There's a new padlock. It wasn't there last night. Anne looks up and sees them then. The two men with guns. One is smashing something on the ground. The other is pacing. She doesn't know if they've seen her. She knows she can't go this way. She doesn't know where to go. She turns and runs back to her home. She runs from the men with guns. She runs from her husband and her youngest son. The men could kill her, but they don't want to kill her. For Anne, their wife and mother, they've planned a fate far crueler than death. And now they are executing that plan. Anne runs back through her house. She escapes at a side entrance and runs into the fields. She runs along the ditches. She tries to stay out of sight. She runs in the cold, damp darkness for almost half an hour before reaching a neighbor's farm. She knocks at the front door and tries to explain what is happening at her home. She says, "They done what they did to make me suffer." Moments later, a shot is heard in the distance. When a person is killed in Ireland, the Gardaí turn to the forensic examiners of the Technical Bureau. And for 25 years, I was one of them. I'm John Sweetman. At crime scenes, I learned to listen to what the evidence was saying and what the killer was trying to silence. A smudged print, a misplaced everyday object, the smallest detail that revealed the truth. Now, in this Go Loud original podcast, I return to some of Ireland's most compelling cases. This is Lines of Inquiry, a podcast that follows the evidence and reveals the story behind each case. In this episode, we explore the tragic events at an isolated farmhouse in County Cork, where the breakdown of a family led to one of the darkest crimes in recent Irish history. This is Lines of Inquiry, Tragedy at Raheen. Anne O'Sullivan was born in 1959. She was the only child of Timothy and Mary Cronin, and she grew up on Raheen, a farm in the townland of Asullis, close to the town of Castlemagner in County Cork. It was a large farm, 115 acres, in prime land. That part of Cork is a stretch of fertile land as good as anywhere on the island, with rich, rolling grasslands perfect for dairy farming. It is beautiful land, and it is valuable land. A farm of 115 acres could today command a price of several million euro. It was a scenic, gentle place to grow up, and Anne's home was a happy one. Despite being an only child, the nearby area was dotted with their wider family, including the Sherlocks, with their seven girls, who would call Anne the eighth sister. The farming life didn't call to Anne. She studied nursing and went on to work at Mount Alvernia Hospital outside Mallow, where she was highly respected and worked a job she cared for deeply and enjoyed very much. In 1985, her father, Timothy, died suddenly. From then it was just Anne and her mother, Mary, in the house on the sprawling farm. They leased the land to neighbouring farmers, allowing them to use it for a fee. It was 6 years later, in 1991, when Anne met a mechanic named Tig O'Sullivan from nearby Cecilstown. He also came from a farming family, but one with a far less impressive plot of land. The O'Sullivan farm was smaller, just 30 acres, and far from the prime rolling hills of Raheen. It was mostly bogland, not worked much. Tig, like Anne, was not called to the farming life, and he had become a mechanic. Tighe was a twin, but his sister died at a young age, leaving him to grow up as an only child on his family's farm. His parents were said to be fiercely protective of him. He had inherited the 30-acre farm from his parents by the time he and Anne had married in 1993, 2 years after they met. They married in a ceremony in Rome, and they honeymooned there too. After their wedding, Tighe moved into the house at Raheen to live with Anne and her mother. Coming from his family's more modest farm, you can imagine Tighe would have been quite impressed the first time he travelled the long, narrow boreen that led from the main road all the way to the house at Raheen. The farmhouse was set far from the nearest road, down that long laneway. The narrow approach hemmed in by hawthorn trees and tall hedges, before giving way to the onrushing view of those green fields rolling into the distance. As they travelled further from the outside world, he would have seen the one-story house with its outbuildings around it. Stone sheds with metal roofs, filled with machinery and turf, and all of them sitting in the shadows of the tall old trees that stood around them like a looming wall. It could feel like absolute isolation. Beautiful isolation. 1 year later, in 1994, Mark was born, the first child of Anne and Tighe. Mark's younger brother, Dermot, followed 3 years later. Anne continued her work as a nurse. Tighe carried on his work as a mechanic. He was seen as a quiet, humble man with an excellent knowledge of cars, and a man who loved his wife and children. They were a quiet family. Neither Tighe nor Anne drank alcohol. They were good Catholics and had met at a Legion of Mary meeting. Tighe was involved in the local GAA, and Anne was a regular at local community events and often got involved in fundraising work around the area. Going off what people would say about Tighe many years later, it appears that the public image of him as a good family man held firm, although there will also be later second-hand claims that he was an occasionally abusive father and husband who could be violent with Anne and her sons until his eldest son Mark grew bigger. The boys look strikingly different for brothers. Mark was 6 feet tall, well-built, and with a wide face that held a big smile. Dermot was far slighter, with a narrow face and a sharp nose. In 2012, Anne was diagnosed with breast cancer. She underwent a course of radiotherapy, with Tighe taking her to her appointments. In April of the following year, 2013, she was given the all-clear. But sadly, just 1 month later, her mother Mary passed away. With that, Anne inherited the entire 115-acre family farm. Typically, when a wife and a married couple inherits a farm, the tradition would be that the land is legally split between her and her husband. But in this case, Anne remained the sole owner. Similarly, Tighe remained the sole owner of his family's land, which he had inherited before they married. While this wasn't necessarily the normal way of things, it also wasn't apparently an issue for Anne or Tighe. They didn't farm the land themselves at any point, but leased parcels of it to neighbouring farmers. That would have earned them the equivalent of about €30,000 a year in today's terms. Tighe did work on the land, maintaining it, nurturing it, but he never farmed it. One farming habit or custom maybe that they did keep up was the presence of guns in the home. Tighe had a gun safe with 3 legally owned rifles stored inside. Mark and Dermot both pursued careers that would take them far from the farm. Mark graduated with a law degree and later a master's in law. Dermot qualified as an accountant with a degree in financial and business management. Mark was the more outgoing of the two. He was upbeat and friendly. He was kind and caring. He was good company. During his college years, he worked part-time at a local nursing home. He won an award from his university for his generosity in helping foreign students who came to Limerick to study. He spent a year studying in Athens, getting a good handle on the Greek language while he was there. And he had had a succession of girlfriends, although none who reached the point of making a visit to the family home. He had a tattoo on his arm. It read, Raheen. Dermot was quieter. Not unliked, it seems, but a young man some people felt was often lost in his own thoughts. He was a bit of a quiet mystery to some. He had friends, but but none close enough to call into the family home. He would go on to earn a first-class honours degree in accounting, although a couple of years into the course, he had decided it was not what he truly wanted. Mark graduated from the University of Limerick in 2017. There's a photo of him from the ceremony, standing tall above his parents. His mother's arm is wrapped around his, with her smiling face pressed into her son's shoulder. His father is by his side too, a smile on his face with his hands clasped together at the waist. As the two boys became young men, Dermot grew closer to Tadhg. He would tell Mark how he adored their father. It seems he said it a lot. Dermot and Tadhg shared the love of the outdoors, and as time went on, they came to spend much of their time together. They started their own small business selling firewood from trees on their land. Dermot would advertise it each week in the local Corkman newspaper. Unlike the older Mark, who had a clear path in life set out and was already working as a trainee solicitor, Dermot wasn't sure what he wanted to do. He was training as an accountant, and he worked part-time in a hardware shop. If he didn't know what the path was for him, he seemed to know the destination he wanted. He longed to make his own money, and a lot of it. His interest in making money verged on an obsession, and Mark would complain to friends about his younger brother's determination to make as much of it as he could. Tadhg indulged his youngest son's drive to build his fortune, but Mark and Anne had less time for it, and often dismissed Dermot's ideas as fleeting notions that soon disappeared. Mark noticed something of a shift in Dermot around 2018. He told a college friend, Sharmila Rahman, that his brother wouldn't speak to him or their mother much at home, and when he did, he was often rude. Mark felt his younger brother was spoilt. He complained that when it came to Dermot and Tadhg's business selling firewood, his brother would let his father do the chopping, then sell the wood and keep the money for himself. While Dermot and Tadhg grew closer, so too did Mark and Anne. The family was slowly becoming two distinct parts. That fundamental split began to show late in 2019. By the end of that year, Dermot had stopped talking to his mother altogether. The exact reasons are not clear, but part of it may have been that the younger son felt unappreciated by her and was left hurt by moments when he felt his work or good deeds went without thanks, while he felt his older brother was constantly showered with praise by Anne. Whether that was true, we don't know, but it appears that's how Dermot viewed it. Whatever the cause, by late 2019, the relationship had all but broken down. At the same time, his bond had grown with his father to the point that close relatives of the family would think the pair seemed inseparable. It's not exactly clear what the relationship between Anne and Tadhg was like at this time. Like much of this story, the picture is incomplete. Whatever was brewing under the surface, they were still on speaking terms. Their relationship didn't break down at the same time as Dermot and Anne's did, but it wasn't a perfect marriage, and we know it had become strained in recent years. At one point, Tadhg had mocked Anne over the death of a relative of hers who had taken their own life. On the 28th of February, 2020, Tadhg drove Anne to a medical appointment at the Bon Secours Hospital in Cork. She had been unwell in recent weeks. The news they received that day would set the course for everything that was to come. Anne was once again diagnosed with cancer. It had returned. But this time it was terminal. Anne and Tadhg returned home to Raheen that evening, carrying with them the weight of the news that she was dying. She was facing the agony of chemotherapy and surgery, but knowing she would not survive. That night, Tadhg and Dermot left the home to go for a walk. When they returned, everything changed. Tadhg told his wife, "Get your affairs in order." Anne had not written a will. The land was potentially worth millions. Time was running out. Mark O'Sullivan would tell a friend that when he heard his mother's cancer diagnosis, He was devastated. He remembered that his brother smirked. The news of Anne's illness changed the world inside the home at Raheen in an instant. Outside the boundaries of the farm, the wider world was also changing in unprecedented ways as the COVID-19 pandemic took hold. Within weeks, Ireland would be in a full lockdown, with the country shutting down. The O'Sullivan family were cocooned in the isolation of Raheen, a long walk from even their closest neighbours, with just each other to fill their worlds. At this stage, Mark was 26 years old, Dermot was 23, Anne and Tighe were both 60. With the O'Sullivan family confined to each other's company, and with Anne's terminal diagnosis, the tension between the slowly drifting halves of the family over the past few years would be laid bare. Over the next couple of months, Dermot and Tighe brought up the issue of the land, again and again. Dermot believed he should receive the bulk of the 115 acres, with Mark only getting the house and a small corner of the land around it. He told his mother that Mark was lazy and no good with his hands. He had never and could never work the land. He told her he loved the land. He loved working on it. He said Mark didn't deserve an inheritance. He had done nothing to deserve it. Mark couldn't care for Raheen like he could. Their father sided with Dermot and egged him on. Anne wanted to split the land evenly between her sons. With Dermot already promised Tighe's family farm of 30 acres, she felt strongly that she had to ensure Mark was looked after. To Dermot and Tighe, this was an outrage. Dermot understood the land, what it was to work it. By rights, it should be his. On the 4th of March, Tighe and Dermot confronted Anne in her bedroom. They urged her to make her decision on the inheritance. They called her lazy and indecisive. Tighe said she was like a lazy cow stuck in the ditch and wouldn't move. Tighe's eyes were red and bulging. The row left Anne frightened. The home slowly became toxic. Tighe told Anne he only married her to better himself. He told her he had married her only for her land. Their entire marriage, their lives together, the family raised, the home built, was reduced to a transaction. He told his wife he had never loved her. Tighe and Dermot would call Mark lazy. They would complain he spent all day on his computer in his room. He was working from home due to the COVID-19 lockdown. He was also spending a lot of time caring for his ill mother. But in the eyes of his brother and father, he should have been outside, doing work with his hands. He was not up to it. He was less than them. The harassment ranged from the sinister to the seemingly ridiculous, but still menacing. Dermot began to follow Mark around the home, spraying an air freshener into rooms after Mark had left. Dermot began reading Anne's post as it came to the house. He and his father would call Mark overweight and lazy. Tighe and Dermot would say Anne would be better off dying quickly. Dermot threatened to turn off her cancer treatment machine while she slept. The strain on Mark was growing. He was treated in hospital several times for stomach problems and weight loss issues. He struggled with his mental health. On July 4th, Dermot felt the sting of rejection in a way that perhaps only he could have noticed. But he held on to it. He woke early that day and worked outside, putting in hours of work around the grounds of the house. When he came in, Anne offered no thank you. She didn't even mention it. But at dinner that night, she asked Mark to pass the salt, and she thanked him. That was Dermot's memory of it. It's possible nobody else remembered it at all. Whatever the truth of that particular day, Dermot felt he was ignored by his mother, and his hard work went unappreciated and unacknowledged. And he never let that go. On the 16th of July, Dermot told his mother his vision for the property, as he put it. He told her he would likely spend his life in debt because of it. Dermot didn't see himself running the farm, but possibly had designs on turning the property from one that took an annual lease income of €30,000 into a tract of land that could be used for development. Tighe and Dermot told Anne that Raheen was static and not progressing, and they knew what to do with it. That day in July, Anne told Dermot her wish was for the land to be divided evenly. An enraged Dermot said she had 1 week to make her decision, to agree to granting him the vast bulk of the land. He warned her that if she did not, there would be consequences. The next day, Tadhg asked Mark to join him for a walk. The issue of the land came up, but in a way it hadn't before. Tadhg told his eldest son that if he didn't convince Anne to give Dermot the land, the consequence would be the death of his younger brother. He told his son, "If your mother doesn't change the will and leave your brother the land, he will kill himself." And he told Mark, "It will be your fault." Death was now part of the conversation. It would be impossible to remove it. Dermot would make the same threat to Mark, adding in that if he got the land, he would no longer be suicidal. 1 week later, Dermot asked Anne if she had come to a decision. She hadn't. Dermot told her what Tadhg told Mark. If he didn't get what he felt was rightly his, then he would take his own life. Tadhg was angry. He was growing angrier. And that day he supported his son in the things that he was saying. Saying he would take his own life. He told Anne, speaking about their child, "He will do it. He will do it." Tadhg encouraged Dermot. He told Mark and Anne that his only son, meaning Dermot, should get what he wanted. Then he went further. He told Anne he would follow their son into debt, at his own hand if it came to it. The conversation finished with them warning Anne that if she did not give in, she would be following two coffins to a cemetery, and crying crocodile tears. Anne would not bend to the threats. She would not abandon Mark in this, but she knew she had to do something. She went to see her solicitor. He wrote her a letter to explain that in her medical condition, she wasn't fit to write a will. She returned home to Raheen and she handed this letter to Dermot. If it was intended to put a pause on the talk around the will, he had no interest in hesitating. That night, he and Mark went for a walk, and they were gone from the home for an hour and a half. When they got back, Dermot told Anne that it was settled. Mark had agreed to a split where he would get the house and a smaller share of the farmland, and his younger brother would take the rest. Dermot, it seems, felt the agreement was amicable and would hold. He felt it was done. It seemed for a moment that there may be a way out of the darkness that had been drawing in across Raheen. Tadhg and Dermot perhaps felt that they had won what was theirs by right. Anne felt the mood lift, if just for a little. But it would not last. Mark soon admitted to a friend he felt stupid for agreeing to it. He had backed down, he had let them intimidate him. He had surrendered his own free will. Anne asked him if he was happy with the agreement. He had to admit no, he wasn't. He just did it to calm Dermot, to keep the peace. Throughout it all, Mark continued to care for his sick mother. He did her shopping, he cooked for her, he took her to her hospital appointments. Through the fog of anger and fear, he cared for her. In September, Anne went to Dublin for surgery. Mark brought her. He stayed in Dublin while she was in hospital recovering. He felt a release from his fear. For the first time in a long time, he felt human again. He didn't have to worry about his mother being attacked if he left her side for a moment, even to go to the bathroom. On September 17th, Anne O'Sullivan wrote her will. She had made her decision. She didn't tell Tadhg or Dermot. She didn't discuss anything about it. She kept the document in her handbag, close to her at all times. When she went for medical appointments in Dublin, Mark would hide it in his car, disguised in among books and loose papers. But there was no way to keep it hidden forever. On the 9th of October, 2020, Tadhg visited his own solicitor to write his will. When he got home, he talked to Anne about it. He then asked her about her own will. Had she drawn it up yet, he wanted to know. She had, she said. What was in it, he wanted to know. She had tweaked it slightly, she said. It was not what he had wanted. Not what Dermot had wanted. It was not what they had expected. It was not the deal Mark had agreed to, with Dermot taking the majority of the land. She would split the land evenly between her sons, as she always intended. Dermot flew into a rage. He felt betrayed. He thought he and Mark had settled it with their agreement. He called his brother a rat and a snake. The argument went on for 3 hours. In those hours, the O'Sullivan family would pass the point of no return. Dermot laid out a new, darker vision for their home. He told his brother and mother that he would leave a trail of destruction, and no light would ever shine in Raheen again. Looking back at that fateful night, Anne would remember how Mark didn't engage with this. He stepped away from it and remained distant from it all. She would look back much later and realize her older son understood what was happening. Mark could see something she couldn't. Despite seeming calm in the heat of the argument, by this point Mark was living the deepest kind of fear. Each day in his home, he felt the threat stalking him, in every room, around every corner. Earlier that day, before the argument, he had told a close friend, Clara Lucy, that he was afraid to be alone with Tadhg or Dermot. Then the following day, on October 10th, after hearing Dermot's promise of a trail of destruction, Mark told Clara he feared his father and brother would murder him and make it look like a suicide. He asked her to make sure that if he was to die, she would go to the Gardaí and show them his messages, to let them know he had not taken his own life. Clara told Mark to leave Raheen, to go somewhere safe. Mark wasn't sleeping much. On some nights, as the menace at Raheen grew and darkened, he lay at the foot of his mother's bed throughout the night. Anne told him to go to his own bed, but he wouldn't leave. He lay there for hours in the dark, listening to the sounds of the house at night, terrified in his childhood home. He knew he should run, he wanted to run, but he stayed to protect his mother. It was around this point that Mark wrote a letter. To nobody in particular, it seems, maybe just to record what was happening. He wrote, "I feel like a caged animal that has been consistently prodded by abusive captors. I no longer feel safe at home. My own safety and my mother's is in danger. Raheen has always been my home, and it causes me much distress that it is no longer a safe haven. There are two of them, and they are becoming more and more desperate, and I fear they will get physical. Saturday, Sunday is where it escalated to a new level. My brother threatened to leave a trail of destruction behind him, and there would be no lights on in Raheen ever again." At several points in the letter, Mark wrote the word father, but later scribbled each one out and replaced it with Tadhg. Mark told a college friend, Sharmila Rahman, about Dermot's promise that there would be no lights in Raheen ever again. She took it as a murder threat. She told Mark to get out. She told him it wasn't safe. He told her he knew, but his mother wouldn't leave, and he wouldn't go without her. 2 days after the row that saw Dermot promise that there would be no light left in Raheen, on October the 11th, Anne's cousin Louise Sherlock drove to the farm. As she travelled the long laneway leading to the house, Tadhg and Dermot blocked her way in a van. They stopped in front of her car and got out. Louise looked at them. She would later remember Tadhg was ice cold, expressionless. He said to her, "I'm looking at you, and I'm eyeballing you. I am not blinking." Then Dermot told her this will all be over in a couple of weeks. He promised there would be a road of carnage. Louise drove on to the house. She was shaking when she reached Anne. The next day, October 12th, Anne and Mark decided to move in with Louise and her family, a couple of miles from Raheen. Mark took his framed degrees and certificates. He was worried that Dermot and Tadhg would deface them while he was gone. It was Mark's idea to move out of Raheen, to go to the safety of the Sherlock home. Anne would later say, "Looking back now, I know why he was afraid." That night, Mark slept, for the first time in a while. He slept knowing that they were safe away from home. The following day, Louise Sherlock went to the Garda station in nearby Kanturk. Anne had never considered reporting the threats to the police, but her cousin felt someone had to. She walked into the station and asked for advice. She didn't specify which family she was talking about, but she told Gardaí about her encounter on the laneway with Dermot and Tighe, and about the promise of carnage to come. The Gardaí told her that the people being threatened could contact a solicitor to seek a barring order. They told her that without a specific complaint they could not go any further. The guard on duty told Louise that the people being threatened should come to the station themselves to make a statement. If they did, then the Gardaí could take more action. But Anne decided not to go. The guard on duty gave Louise the number for the Garda station and told her to make sure that the people she was talking about had a copy of their air code in case they needed to call for help. And Garda Síochána would later conduct an internal review into how this incident was handled and also of their own policies around handling third-party reports of intimidation, in particular, cases where firearms were accessible. While staying with the Sherlocks, Anne contacted her solicitor for advice. He told her to text her husband to see if she could find a peaceful resolution, but Tighe never responded. After this, Anne's solicitor sent letters to Tighe and Dermot, demanding that they cease their campaign of intimidation, and warning that if they didn't, he would seek barring orders, getting Gardaí to remove them from the home if needed. Tighe replied. He wrote through his solicitor, saying that whatever differences they had with Anne, he was sure they could resolve them. They were clear. Anne and Mark should come home. Anne read that letter on Friday, October 23rd. She took it as a chance to make peace. Anne wanted to go home. That same day, Tighe and Dermot wrote two other letters, one each. They didn't send them anywhere. They would keep them close. But they intended for Anne to read them soon. In my role as a Garda handwriting expert, I would also read those letters soon. At 3 p.m. on Sunday, 25th of October, Anne and Mark packed their things into Mark's car and prepared to go home. They cried as they did. Mark didn't want to go back, but he wouldn't leave his mother alone. Louise Sherlock insisted they save the number for Kanturk Garda Station in their phones and keep their air code close to hand, just in case. What went through their minds driving that long laneway up to the farmhouse at Raheen? On that Sunday afternoon in October, as they approached the home they had fled in fear, what were they thinking? What could anyone think? Anne wanted to go home. Mark did not. Mark couldn't sleep at Raheen. He was afraid to leave his mother alone in their home. Anne thought there was a chance for peace, for calm. Anne would not change her will. She wouldn't change her mind. She would not, it seems, abandon her son Mark after death, leaving him with less than his brother. And Mark in turn would not abandon his mother. Not when he feared his brother and father might murder him, not even in those recent days when his friends and relatives had pleaded with him to run from that place. It seems that neither mother nor son would abandon the other, and that loyalty led them both to that narrow road, returning to Raheen that Sunday afternoon. Mark parked the car outside the house. He took some bags of food shopping from the boot, supplies picked up from the local Lidl on the way home. Anne went to the door of the house. It was unlocked. She went in. The television was on, but nobody was home. Anne sat on the couch, and 10 minutes later, Dermot and Tighe came in. They went to wash their hands. Then Dermot approached his mother. He told her, "I will say hello and ask, how are you? But that is as far as it goes." He told Anne he'd been getting calls asking if there was trouble in the home. Tighe stepped in and told Dermot to stop, he had said enough. Anne felt the coldness from them. She felt the tension there, just as it had been for so long. Anne and Mark moved to a separate room of the house, where they lit the stove and watched television. That day was the first of winter. The clocks had gone back the night before. Darkness came an hour earlier, drawing in around 5 p.m. Just after 6 o'clock, Tadhg and Dermot left the home. Anne and Mark didn't know where they had gone. Mark ate some dinner and said goodnight to his mother. He told her he loved her, and she told him she loved him too. Anne fell asleep watching the TV and woke up around 8 o'clock. She turned the television off and went to bed. At some point, she took the wireless landline phone and placed it in its cradle in the parlour. Dermot and Tadhg were still not home. During the night, she woke and went to the toilet. She passed Dermot asleep on the couch in the kitchen where he had been sleeping recently. The TV in the kitchen was on. Anne turned it off. She didn't know if Dermot was awake. If he was, he didn't let her know. Anne went back to bed. In just a few hours, darkness would fall on Raheen. Around 6 a.m. the following morning, on October 26th, Anne O'Sullivan woke in bed. She could hear movement around the house. She presumed it was Tadhg. She thought it was odd. That day was a bank holiday Monday, and he wasn't due to go to work. Roughly 30 minutes later, a noise woke Anne again. It was loud. She climbed out of bed and put on her dressing gown and shoes. She walked out to the hall. She saw Tadhg and Dermot, both holding guns and facing into Mark's bedroom. Anne asked them what they had done. As she did, the two men fired shots into the room where Mark slept in the lower of the bunk beds, his childhood bedroom. Anne ran to her bedroom to get her phone. Dermot took the phone from her and told her, "There's your solicitor's letter for you." Tadhg never spoke a word. Dermot and Tadhg walked away, leaving the house. Anne went to Mark. He had fallen from the bed. He was lying on the floor, propped up against the bed and bedside locker. Blood poured from his mouth. The duvet and sheets were wrapped around his legs. He wore nothing but his underwear. They had shot him in the face. He was lifeless. Anne went to get the landline phone where she had left it the night before, but it was missing. She knew she had to leave Raheen, to find someone outside. Before she left, she said to Mark, "Hold on, I'm going to get help." She took the key to the courtyard gate and ran outside. She ran to the gate to unlock it. The gate was locked with a new, large padlock. She couldn't get out. She saw Dermot and Tadhg outside the courtyard wall. Dermot was smashing something on the ground, her phone. Tadhg was pacing. Anne wasn't sure if Tadhg saw her. Dermot was looking the other way. She turned and fled back to the house. She left through a side door into a small garden. In the dark morning, she ran to the fields. She ran along ditches, trying to stay out of sight. She ran for a kilometre. She emerged from the field down onto the road and ran into the yard of the Cronin's farm. It had taken her half an hour. Anne knocked on the door and the Cronins answered. She told them Tadhg and Dermot had shot Mark in front of her. She told them that they did it to make her suffer. The Cronins called Kanturk Garda Station. While they waited for Gardaí to arrive, the Cronins heard another gunshot in the distance. As they heard the story of what had unfolded that morning at Raheen, the local Gardaí called for assistance. The word went out to all Gardaí rushing to the scene and up the chain of command. They needed urgent backup. Two men, armed and potentially barricaded inside the house, but also potentially anywhere on the 115-acre farm or somewhere further. There were at least three guns in the house. A dozen uniformed Gardaí and plainclothes detectives arrived at the entrance to Raheen, looking up the long road to the house as the sun rose. They didn't know what lay inside. A hostage situation? Two men determined to open fire on anyone who approached? Or had they already fled? By 7:30 a.m., 1 hour after Anne had woken to the sound of gunshots, Gardaí were in position around the house, with an outer cordon in place along the roads and lanes that encircled the farm. At 8:15 a.m, the armed support unit arrived and took up positions close to the house and the outer buildings dotted around it. A trained negotiator tried to make contact with Dermot and Tig. They called out to the house using a loudhailer. They called their phones. They rang out or didn't ring at all. At 8:30 a.m, a nationwide media blackout was put into effect, barring any reporting on the unfolding scene. At 9 a.m, a Coast Guard helicopter landed at the nearby Castlemagner GAA fields with a team of paramedics on board. Each was equipped with bulletproof vests and helmets. At some point, armed detectives went to the home of Anne's solicitor, fearing he may be a target for Dermot and Tig. At 10:38, Sharmila Rahman, Mark's friend who had days earlier told him to leave the house, sent him a text. She had not received a reply to her message to him the previous night. She wrote, "What's the story? You haven't been online. Worried." Around midday, an Air Corps helicopter landed on the local GAA pitch. Members of the ERU, the Emergency Response Unit, stepped out onto the playing field. The ERU are the highest level of armed policing in Ireland. The unit is deployed in the most critical situations. By the time they arrived at Raheen, dozens of armed Gardaí encircled the home. At 12:26 p.m, armed Gardaí with bulletproof shields entered the house. They found the lifeless body of Mark O'Sullivan slumped by his bunk bed in his bedroom next to the kitchen. His brother and father had shot him 7 times, including in his arm where he'd seemingly tried to protect himself. Gardaí searched the rest of the home, but it was empty. They searched the outer buildings, methodically going from one to the next, scanning for any sign of Tig or Dermot. All empty. A local Garda from Kanturk station had to tell Anne O'Sullivan that her son Mark was dead. The armed Gardaí went into the fields around the home, moving slowly. At 1:40 p.m, a Garda helicopter flew above the farm, searching the wide green fields below. They spotted the bodies of 2 men lying in a field about 500 metres from the house. Guns lay beside the bodies of Dermot and Tig. That same local Garda then had to tell Anne O'Sullivan that her husband and younger son were also dead. As Gardaí examined the bodies of the 2 men, it became apparent that they had taken their own lives. Later, ballistic tests would find Dermot shot himself first, then his father followed. Gardaí found a handwritten letter wrapped in cling film around Dermot's leg. It was 21 pages long. It was addressed to his mother. They found another on the body of Tig. His was 2 pages long, also addressed to Anne. As a handwriting expert, my job was to prove the authorship of these letters. I would not necessarily be concerned with the content, but in this case, what was written told me there was perhaps more than just land and money to this story. Maybe things ran far deeper. It was Dermot's letter that said the most. When I examined those pages, I made my notes, sketched the individual letters and their constructions, and analysed the variations in the writing. Looking back at my notes now, I can see certain repeated words. Words such as mother, favouritism, lies, and ungrateful. These were words written by a son who claimed in his letter that he was unloved by his mother, who said he had lived his entire life as second best, always in the shadow of his older brother. He wrote of the land too, and his desire to keep it, of course. He wrote about the will and his anger over how he had been treated by his mother. But besides the land and the inheritance, he talked a lot about his deep, long-standing emotional pain. Pain that went back far further than the past 6 months. He wrote how he felt he never got the love he deserved from his mother. There was anger and resentment, bottled up over a lifetime. And now it had been unleashed. It was clear he wrote the letter to hurt his mother. He told Anne she had driven him to do what he did. He detailed specific moments in his life when he felt humiliated or verbally abused. He wrote about incidents that ranged from the few weeks before the deaths right back to his time in junior infants. There were 21 pages. There was a lot to unpack. But they were not the disordered ramblings of a man who has lost his grip on reality. I've seen letters like that, and this wasn't one of them. He clearly had his own views of several key moments in the story of Raheen. They were views that didn't match up with those of Mark or Anne. How much of what is in that letter was true or fair, nobody will ever know. Those words were written by a man who would 3 days later kill his own brother and take his own life, alongside his father. He wanted the letter to be read, and surely wrote the story he wanted people to hear. Where the truth lay in those pages, if anywhere, we will never know. If we can believe any of it, we can believe Dermot was a young man with deep resentments. He admits he saw himself as the black sheep of the family. He told his mother she hated to see him smile. He listed time after time that he remembered she failed to give him thanks or any kind of praise. Dermot signed his letter, "The son you never appreciated." This was maybe not just about land, not just about money. The road to that terrible morning started far further back. Tighe wrote in his letter that he wished for him and Dermot to be buried together. "Died together, buried together, together forever," he wrote. It is important to remember that suicide is an extremely complex issue. There is never any single cause. Serious mental health issues are at its core, but it is never simple. What someone might write in their final days is not likely to be a full accounting of all those causes. In a search of the home, Gardaí found a 2-page letter from Mark. It was undated and unsigned, but I was able to establish that he had written it. He had written it in October, as the family entered their final trajectory. It laid out his fears inside the home, and how that had grown over recent months. Were it not for that letter and his messages to friends, the story of Raheen would likely have remained a total mystery. Four days after their deaths, a funeral was held for Tighe and Dermot at St. Mary's Church in Castlemagner. Their coffins were brought into the church quietly in the early hours of the morning. Before the ceremony began, Anne sat alone inside the church with the two coffins for 40 minutes. The two men were buried in the O'Sullivan family grave with Tighe's parents. Their graves were left unmarked for many months to come. Mark was buried the following day in a separate cemetery. His funeral mass took place in a different church to the one where his father and brother had been brought the previous day. At the ceremony, a eulogy written by his friend Sharmila Rahman was read. She said, "Mark was the greatest son a mother could have, and I know the bond between Mark and Anne was unbreakable. Mark was the most caring and selfless person I ever met. So caring and selfless that he earned a nickname, Mother Mark. I struggled to put into words how amazing Mark was. To say he was amazing seems like an injustice to who he really was. He was charming, funny, caring, selfless, bright, hardworking, honest, intelligent, but also so much more." Anne O'Sullivan died just 6 months later, in April of 2021. She had never returned to the home at Raheen. She never read those letters written by Dermot or Tighe. An inquest into the deaths was conducted in 2021. It revealed much of the story, and much of what we have told you in this episode, but it could never fully explain what happened at Raheen. This case was one played out inside a family, inside a home, with only minor flashes shown to the outside world. There is much more we will never know, and much nobody can ever understand. Some things, often the most tragic things, are inexplicable. If you or anyone you know has been impacted by issues discussed in this episode, you can contact the Samaritans 24 hours a day, 365 days a year on 116-123. Thank you for listening to this episode of Lines of Inquiry. We now have an email address, linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com, and we would love to hear from you, so get in touch. Whether you have a story you think we should cover, or just want to let us know how you felt about an episode, that email is linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com. If you're listening on Spotify, please leave a comment on this episode and let us know what you think of the podcast. We really appreciate those who have taken time to give the podcast a review. With almost 1,000 five-star ratings on Spotify already, I am genuinely humbled by the support. Thank you. Your support helps us to tell these stories. If you haven't yet rated the podcast, I would be grateful if you could give us a five-star rating wherever you're listening, sharing it on your story on Instagram, or simply telling a friend that you're listening to the podcast. Make sure to like or follow the podcast in your podcast app and hit the notifications button so you'll know every time a new episode is released. Lines of Inquiry is presented by me, John Sweetman. The podcast is created by Darren Cleary. Our executive producer is Owen Brennan. Our producers are Siobhan Maguire and Siobhan Walsh. Sound editing and design by Neil Kavna, with additional editing support from Ed Smith. Social media, marketing, video, and legal support comes from the Go Loud team. This episode was written by Owen Brennan, with script editing from myself and research by Siobhan Maguire and Owen Brennan. In the end, everything done in the dark comes to light.